case number five. $10,340.6 and $12,1361, United States of America versus Castaldi. And
good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Adam Stevenson, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Frank Castaldi. Mr. Castaldi's two principal sentencing arguments demonstrate that this substantively unreasonable sentence frustrates federal sentencing purposes and illuminates the need for greater clarity at sentencing. First, the case began, but more importantly, ended with Mr. Castaldi. Without Mr. Castaldi's voluntary disclosure and continuing cooperation, the conduct of which the government was neither aware nor investigating may have gone undiscovered. The government, in fact, argued for a bottom-of-the-guideline sentence for this very fact. In addition, despite a clearly erroneous district court statement to the contrary, a guidelines policy statement explicitly covered this extraordinary disclosure.
What do you believe was the district court's most significant error?
The most significant error in this case was failing to respond to Mr. Castaldi's two primary arguments, both the disparity and the voluntary disclosure. The voluntary disclosure possibly even more significant, given that it was an argument both of Mr. Castaldi but also the government for a much lesser sentence than what Mr. Castaldi ended up receiving. The failure to consider that argument under Cunningham and as further explained in Dean and Miranda is procedural error.
Who do you think bears the burden of identifying policy considerations that the court must consider? See, you're a professor, so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the burden to bring up can rest on the defense. However, federal law also requires the district court to consider guideline policy statements under 18 U.S.C. 3553. So a district court must consider that. So even if forfeited, the failure to consider the policy statement at issue in this case is clearly erroneous, where the district court indicated its duty to acknowledge a guidelines policy statement, however stated there is none that apply.
Do we know any pyramid schemes? Maybe this is a tautological question, but do pyramid schemes go undiscovered? Eventually, don't they collapse?
It's unclear, Your Honor, and I guess I do not know one that has not been discovered for obvious reasons.
The nature of the business is that eventually people are going to ask for their money back, right? Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to determine, and findings with regard to that matter in the district court would have been beneficial to understand why
the policy statement had been brought to the judge's attention.
Correct, or had the district court properly recognized that it may imply and therefore would have considered the findings and facts in that case.
So however, how does that satisfy plain error? Mm-hmm.
I would argue that the failure to even acknowledge it and, in fact, mistakenly ignore it is plain error.
Well, it may be error, but you've got to show that it was prejudicial, that in essence that I would think that you'd have to show that the only possible conclusion would be that the requirements of 5K2.16 were in fact met.
Given the expertise of the Sentencing Commission and the eventual sentence that was received, one above the guidelines at both statutory maximums and run consecutive for maximum possible effect, It is fairly clear that there is a strong likelihood of prejudice had the judge been aware of the policy statement and the commission's direction with regard to these extraordinary circumstances. Prejudice is a reasonable outcome from the district court's failure to consider this policy argument.
You know, in your reply brief, it says that you brought the substance, in quotes, of 5K216 to the district court's attention. Did you ever identify it by name in your pre-sentencing?
Trial counsel did not specifically identify the policy statement. However, there was a lengthy discussion on the part of both Mr. Castaldi's counsel as well as the government about the extraordinary nature of his voluntary disclosure when the government was, again, neither aware nor investigating the conduct, and the repeated and continued cooperation on the part of Mr. Castaldi to provide information.
So, in other words, what you're saying is that that extensive discussion would have had the same effect on the court as applying 5K216. In other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is, why would we find procedural error if we're convinced that the district court considered the circumstances that make 5K216 applicable, whether or not Judge Darrow mentioned the policy statement?
Your Honor, I believe the unique aspect of the policy statement and the failure to consider it is that the Sentencing Commission, in its detailed review and expertise, has recommendations with regard to these exact circumstances. And the policy statement advocates that a departure from the guideline range or perhaps a lesser sentence is appropriate in these very unique and compelling circumstances.
So it may be warranted.
Correct. And
as I understand it, this man, his father before him, had his own Ponzi scheme, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that both of them used the same mechanism by insisting to their clients, victims or whatever you want to call them, that these were tax exempt. Therefore, they're not reported on their income tax returns. Therefore, the IRS and others had no reason to even be aware of the payments. Is that also part of this?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so it seems to me, and I don't know, but this voluntary disclosure, he basically reached the end of the rope. He realized he can't raise any more money, went to a lawyer, and the lawyer wisely said, hey, you can't go any further, we got to disclose, I guess, and that's when he did all the cooperating. Is that pretty much the sequence?
I would disagree slightly, Your Honor. I would say that it was motivated in large part due to guilt and the depression that Mr. Castaldi suffered and his internal moral compass.
He went to a lawyer first, right?
He did go to a lawyer, yes. However, at the time when he disclosed and during his continuing cooperation, he received no government assurances. There was no specific contracts or other assurances given by the government with regard to his cooperation nor his disclosure.
Okay.
In addition, this case is very much like this court's case in Miranda, where the final sentence in that case was above both parties' recommendations, however, still within the guidelines. This court remanded that case, even though the district court mentioned the arguments and did acknowledge the doctor's expertise. Here, the court made one specific mention of the voluntary disclosure argument, however, provided no further explicit consideration aside from very vague references to considering all mitigating factors. However, as the government itself acknowledges, the district court missed one of the arguments in its listing of the defense counsel's pre-sentence arguments. So given that error, the statement that the district court meaningfully considered all mitigating arguments raised is of questionable validity.
Which one did they miss?
The government notes that they missed the disparity argument and the detailed pre-sentence filing that Mr. Castaldi presented.
We don't know anything in here about whatever happened with the father and his scheme, right?
Correct. There is nothing in the record to discuss what occurred with the father, correct?
And father alive?
To my knowledge, yes. However, the record is unclear.
I think he submitted a letter regarding sentencing, didn't he?
Correct. However, with the passage of time, I am unaware if that's still the case.
The other thing that doesn't seem to come out here is that usually in a 22 years?
Approximately, yes.
Duration, a lot of people got their money back, the early ends, and sometimes the government gets involved and causes discouragement and some other things. We don't know anything about that either, do we? About why some people may not be interested in...
There is not record information to reflect why
individual
investors...
Some victims are a whole lot better off than others, I guess.
That is possible, Your Honor.
Which is always happens, but that's... But I assume the ones that came in and testified were the last ones in or more recent ones in.
I believe that would be a fair assumption, Your Honor, yes.
Okay.
With that, I would like to reserve the remaining time for a vote.
Hi, Ms. Greenwald. How are you?
Your Honors, I'd like to begin with the procedural arguments that that counsel has brought to your attention, both in his brief and at argument. First of all, this is not a case where this is a case where the district court accepted and it's clear on the record, accepted his voluntary cooperation and his self-surrender as a basis for mitigation. In other words, this isn't a case where the judge thought it could not take those factors into consideration. He expressly listed them when he went through the arguments offered by defense counsel in mitigation. He asked a question about it to defense counsel, whether he was represented when he surrendered himself. He said he had considered all the factors brought in mitigation, but they were outweighed by the numerous aggravating factors he went through. I think that's important because, essentially, as Judge Rovner pointed out, 5K 2.16 simply says what the court did, which is that this factor of voluntarily surrendering and cooperation is something you can consider in mitigation in crafting a sentence. The court took it into account. It expressly stated it took it into account, but it found it outweighed by these other factors.
What was the basis of the government's recommendations for a considerably lower sentence?
It absolutely was, Your Honor. In the government's position at sentencing, and we do not disown that, it was our position that a low end of the guideline sentence was appropriate here. The court, within its discretion, disagreed.
Because that's the same thing he's talking that the government or that the judge ignored. Why would the government make that low end recommendation given the vast amount of money and the number of victims?
I wasn't the counsel at the time, but, you know, the government actually, it seemed to me the government put more weight on his voluntary cooperation than the court did. But as this court's
precedent. But now you're arguing that it was most relevant that he had counsel when he turned himself in to the authorities. And, of course, that's not a list.
Wait, no, we're not arguing that. I'm sorry, Your Honor. We're not arguing that he had counsel in connection with his cooperation is relevant. What we're arguing is that that this sentence is not unreasonable. That's essentially what we're arguing.
I think you also certainly noted somewhere in that brief that it was relevant that he had counsel when he turned himself in.
The court asked a question. We put that to the court to say we're addressing their argument, which is essentially that the court made procedural error, that the court ignored defendant's position that he voluntarily cooperated and that he should take that into account in carving out a sentence. And in response to that, we're saying that there is evidence in this record clear that the court did not ignore that argument or ignore that evidence. He asked about it. He asked whether they were represented by counsel. He said, I am considering it. And he said it's outweighed. And I would also point out, Your Honors, that I think the court also, in commenting on another argument made by defense counsel, which was that that the fact that he had not spent this money on a lavish lifestyle and, in fact, as you do in most Ponzi schemes, had returned some of the money to some of his victims, that was somehow mitigating. And the court responded by saying, well, to do that, you had to create more victims. I don't see that as mitigating. Wouldn't it have been better if, essentially, rather than waiting 20 years to end your scheme and turn yourself in, you did it sooner? So clearly the court, while crediting that he had turned himself in and discontinued his crime, also was acknowledging that it took him 20 years to do that.
But you also argued that he didn't qualify for 5K2.
No, he didn't.
Are you able to point to any concrete evidence suggesting that the authorities would have discovered his scheme anytime soon?
Yes. Well, I don't. It soon is not required by that provision, Your Honor. But within a reasonable, lifetime span, yes. One, he in his own version of his offense stated that he was not saying he would never have been caught. He was saying he didn't think they'd ever found out the extent of his scheme or all of his victims. But he said, I'm not saying I wouldn't have been caught. In addition, Your Honor, at his guilty plea, at his sentencing, it's quite clear on the record that he had victims there. And in addition, they went to the bankruptcy court when he was in bankruptcy, which, as Your Honors know from many cases that come here, there are referrals made by the bankruptcy court, not uncommonly, to law enforcement when there has been, you know, shenanigans that show up there.
I don't know. My reading is that at the time he confessed to authorities, they were completely unaware of this scheme.
They were. Absolutely. The government did not know of it. But the test is whether they were likely to ever know of it. And that, by his own admission, he was not saying that they weren't. But in any event, the bottom line of this is, Your Honor, that the judge did accept this in mitigation. He did consider it in mitigation. And it, we are, I believe, under a plain error standard here, because it was not raised by defense counsel, by the probation office, by no one. And it was not brought to the court. The reliance on a particular articulation of a policy statement.
Well, tell me this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the fact that Section 3553A makes consideration of any applicable policy statements mandatory give a district court an independent obligation to raise 5K 2.16?
I am not aware of any case law that would take that particular statutory thing out of plain error. I mean, that can be said, I would imagine, of a lot of directives to courts, and it doesn't typically take it outside of plain error standard. And I'm aware of nothing that does that, Your Honor.
Ms. Greenwald, the one of the arguments that's been made here is that the guidelines already considered the aggravating factors. The guidelines tell us to consider number of victims, right? They tell us to consider the total dollar loss involved. But there's nothing really in the guidelines, is there, that addresses the kind of powerful testimony that this district judge heard, is there?
Absolutely not.
About the psychological and family impact?
Absolutely not. And as we cite in our brief, the Scott case, where the court did go to the statutory maximum based on and above double the guideline range, based on the fact, I believe this case is completely controlling here, based on the fact of the relationship that the fraud, that the person committing the fraud had with his victims, and the fact that the fraud went on for such a long period of time. We also cite the Schutler case, which similarly, the victims in that case were an elderly couple whose retirement monies were taken, as well as a woman who put her husband's life insurance policy in the hands of the defendant. All those cases found it took it out of the heartland of guideline cases. And here you had, compared to, you could fit into his guideline range if you'd committed this scheme for a year or two or five and committed this much fraud. You would have fit into his guideline range if you didn't know your victims at all. You'd fit into this guideline range if you had abused the trust of one or two people. You'd fit into this guideline range if your victims were corporations and had no emotional loss and suffered such devastation as these people did.
Victim upward adjustment insufficient to account for the fact that all of these victims were, Italian American immigrants, some widows, elderly, dealing with health difficulties. I mean, isn't that the purpose of the adjustment?
Well, Your Honor, the government's position would be, first of all, that adjustment wasn't applied here. Abuse of trust was. Vulnerable victim was not. But it hardly captured, I mean, you could get those exact points for vulnerable victim if you did this to one person. He did this to, even if you just rely on the ones that came into court, which we would maintain are very representative, and there was no position taken by the defense at any time that they were anything other than fairly representative. He did this repeatedly to people that by his own admission in his plea agreement were unsophisticated, nothing to do with being Italian, they were unsophisticated just by, they happened to be unsophisticated persons who relied on him as their tax preparer, and in addition to people who were his relatives and close friends. and who, while they started out, and I see my time is up, but while they started out may have been younger, but kept rolling over their investments with him into their elderly years at a time when they no longer had retirement monies due to the fraud. So for all those reasons, Your Honor, we believe the decision is procedurally sound, there was no abuse of discretion, and we'd respectfully request that the sentence be affirmed.
Thanks so much, Ms. Greenwald. Okay, Mr. Stevenson, you have two.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to cover a few points in rebuttal. First, the listing of arguments or mere recitation that a district court considers all mitigating arguments is insufficient to demonstrate meaningful consideration and to allow a sufficient record for appellate review under this court's cases in Cunningham, Dean, Miranda, and subsequent cases that have dealt with this exact issue. Most recently, in fact, in the second appeal of Bradley, where this court remanded yet again that case for resentencing, when the district court, in fact, responded in writing to one of Bradley's primary arguments, a disparity one very similar to Mr. Castaldi's own argument. In addition, with regard to the eventual discovery under 5K2.16, it is very easy now in hindsight to say that, well, of course it would have been found out. Once Mr. Castaldi provided all his records, once he sat with the government over 30 times, and once he disclosed his own offense, it's very easy to say that. However, when the government was neither aware of nor investigating it at the time of indictment or at the time the information was filed, it's impossible to say that in a reasonable amount of time the offense would have been discovered. And finally, Miranda further also demonstrates a case where a policy statement was applied to evaluate the use of mitigating arguments and the response thereto, where Miranda argued, based upon psychological testimony, that both his own offense and his prior criminal history was overstated and impacted by his psychological disorders. Finally, as this court properly notes, the nature of the victims or the characteristics of the victims are considered by the guidelines, the vulnerable victims guideline. Neither the PSR nor the government raised this issue in the district court. For these reasons and the reasons in Mr. Castaldi's brief, we respectfully request this court vacate his sentence as both procedurally erroneous and substantively unreasonable. Thank you.
Thank you to all involved. Case will be taken under advisement. Mr. Stevenson, you were court appointed.